Okay, I'm going to test y'all's ability to make application of things we have learned. What have we learned this quarter that we need to especially remember after the last 3 days?
There won't be another flood.
All right, the rainbow covenant, right? We're not destroying the earth with water. Sometimes it's helpful to remember that. It's been a rainy 3 days. All right, lesson tonight, lesson 7. We're covering Genesis 22 through chapter 25 and verse 11. And we've got quite a bit to cover. We're going to kind of do it very similarly to what we did last week. We're going to try to hit some of the, I guess, some of the main points. I'm convinced that you already know the events that take place in these chapters, and so we kind of want to home in on a few of these and see what good we can do with them. We've been kind of showing this family tree of Abraham all along, and I want to do that again tonight, because tonight we are adding a few more names to that. I've got those in a different color up here. We have Abraham's brother, Nahor, who has a son named Bethuel. Bethuel has a son named Laban and a daughter named Rebekah. Of course, Isaac, Abraham's son, marries Rebekah. We read about that in the account tonight. So, what relation would Rebekah be to Abraham? Brother's granddaughter. She would be his great niece.
That's right.
And, of course, the fact that she is among Abraham's family is a big part of what takes place tonight, right? The servant was sent, find someone of my family for my son to marry. And, of course, we also read about Abraham marrying a lady named Keturah and has several children, but the one we need to remember primarily is Midian. Because Midian becomes the father of the Midianites. And what we will learn later is that the Midianites and the Ishmaelites, and I don't know the full story behind all of this, but they almost kind of assimilated into one another. Ishmaelites, Midianites sort of used interchangeably. So just something to watch as we go forward. Now, we're also introduced to another tribe of people tonight. They're not really in Abraham's family, but what other tribe of people?
Hittites.
The sons of Heth. The sons of Heth. Can anybody tell me the genealogy of Heth?
Heth.
Heth was the son of Canaan, the second son of Canaan. Canaan was the son of Ham, and Ham was the son of Noah. But we will read about the Hittites, of course, quite a bit going forward. So it's always interesting to kind of see the origin of some of these families. And, you know, it's interesting how there are so many things in Genesis that are just kind of introduced to us. You know, we kind of get a little bit of a taste of it, and but then it's kind of helpful to remember that because we'll read much more about it later on. Okay, I wanted to say a few things concerning the order of events as they are recorded in the book of Genesis. Certainly sometimes things are in perfect chronological order, but not always. Not always. And just something to kind of watch out for in our reading. It's easy as we're kind of reading through this, say, well, this happened, and then after that, this happened. Not necessarily. Sometimes, in order to not interrupt the narrative, something is told after that narrative, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it came afterwards. And just as an example of that, Abraham was 100 when Isaac was born, according to chapter 21 and verse 5. He was 137 when Sarah died. We know that because Sarah died at what age? He was 127, and Abraham was 10 years older than her. He was 140 when Isaac married. Because according to chapter 25 and verse 20, Isaac was how old when he got married? 40 years old. He was 160 when Jacob and Esau were born. Because we learn from chapter 25 and verse 26 that Isaac was 60 when Jacob and Esau were born. And he was 175 when he died. Now, all that, I guess, is, you know, I guess could be put in the category of somewhat trivial, but even after the verse, so even though the verses of Jacob and Esau are recorded after Abraham's death, we'll read about that in chapter 25, verses 24 to 26, he did live to see his grandsons. In fact, they would have been how old when he died? They would have been 15 years old. So as we get into the next study, there in chapter 25, well, at least past verse 11, you know, the tendency is to say, well, this happened afterwards, after Abraham's death. But obviously it did not. And one other thing that I might mention, and I'm not at all certain about this. This is just, I guess, a thing that I would urge as sort of a caution to us. It may be that Abraham married Keturah while Sarah was still alive. I know when you open chapter 25, you know, Sarah has already died. It talks about him taking a wife and so forth. You know, some of the translations, you know, when I read it, the New King James, it just almost sounds like, well, okay, now that she's dead, he decides to get another wife. You know, other translations don't make it quite that clear. And I guess one thing that makes me, or at least gives me some pause about that, is how old was Abraham now when Sarah died? 137. Okay. He already had questioned, well, I don't know about question. I mean, he believed God, but I mean, the whole thing about Sarah bearing a son was how incredible it would be that a man 100 years old could give birth to a son. Well, how much more so when he's 137? And it's not just one son, it's a number of them. So, you know, I just wonder if this is another case where Keturah was among the various concubines that he had, and these children may have been born. And even as you go on and read about these sons of the concubines being sent to the land of the east, if you think about the number of sons here, that youngest one would have been pretty young to be sent off. So I'm not certain at all about that. I don't want anybody to think that I'm, you know, if God wanted to bless him with more children, we already seen it. He's got the power to do that. But I just wonder if we need to just kind of stop and think, well, maybe that's not necessarily in the sequence. Okay. I think the thing we need to, of course, spend the most time tonight talking about, or at least emphasize the most, would be the faith of Abraham. So I want us to kind of go into some depth on that. Let's look at the command, first of all, that God gives Abraham. Take now your son, your only son, Isaac. Let's stop there for just a minute. Is that literally true in every sense? No, not his only son. So why would he be referred to as his only son? Yeah, the only son of his wife Sarah, and this is the son through whom the promise is going to be fulfilled. So I think we have to understand it in that sense. Your only son, Isaac, whom you loved. How about that? Added to the command. Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. It's a lot to ask, isn't it? Think about, we've been emphasizing the patience of Abraham and waiting for this promised son to be born, and now the promised son has been born, and God is saying, I want you to take him and offer him as a burnt sacrifice. So, Abraham's response in verse 3, it says, so Abraham protested. Is that the word? So Abraham delayed, lingered. No, that's not it. Somebody read 22 and 3.
So Abraham rose early in the morning and went to
Yeah, it's about how long the journey to this place? 3 days. So no delay, no protest. There's nothing recorded. He gets up early in the morning and he just deliberately sets out to do exactly what God had told him to do. And as we continue reading through the account, is there any hesitation at all? Any protest recorded even after? Yes, not at all. One of the things that I want to say about this is, there's a lot of applications. We'll make some more going forward, but I wanted to stop for just a minute. I still remember reading an article years ago, and I believe it was by Bill Hall, and the title of the article was Challenging Adulterers. And the point that he was making is sometimes we, meet people who are in an adulterous marriage. Married to someone they have no right to, according to the Scriptures. And our temptation is to say what? They'll never do that. There's no way. There's no way they'll leave this person that they love so much. I think that's a good assumption on our part to make. They may very well. I mean, if Abraham would do this, they might very well do that. If they have the faith of Abraham, if they love God the way Abraham loved God, they may very well be. And we can think of other similar situations. Now, obviously we need to turn that on ourselves. And we need to ask ourselves, okay, are there commands of God that we still kind of buck at a little bit? Are there things that, are still kind of troublesome to us? In other words, we're still too hesitant to do them, or maybe not even doing them at all. The faith of Abraham would certainly be a rebuke. If there's anything that God asks us to do that we are presently unwilling to. Alright. Do we see a key word there in verse 5? I think this was in your questions. Yeah, read verse 5 now.
And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you.
Yeah, I don't want to make too much out of that, but that sounds to me like an expression of faith. And I think when we look in just a minute at some of the things said in Hebrews chapter 11 that further explain Abraham's thinking at this time, I think he means what he says. We will come back. We will come back. That doesn't mean he doesn't go ahead and proceed with what God asked him to do. All right, so let's see if we can kind of, look, I'm not trying to say that we can read Abraham's mind, everything that he's thinking, but I believe these are the steps that Abraham would have to make in his thinking, in his faith, to go ahead and go through with this. Of course, God stopped him right before he did it, but he knows that Isaac is the son God promised him. He knows that for sure, right? He also knows that only through Isaac will God's promises be fulfilled. And he's been assured of that. But now, God has commanded me to kill Isaac. Yet, here's what I know. God's promises will be fulfilled. I don't think there's any question in Abraham's mind. That's what happened. God's promises, some way or another, have got to be fulfilled. And so, what does Abraham conclude from that? According to Hebrews 11. Yeah, God will raise him. Therefore, God must be going to raise Isaac from the dead. Again, I think this is based on what we know from other passages, what we'll see here in just a minute from Hebrews chapter 11. In fact, let's look at that. Hebrews 11, 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "And Isaac, your seed shall be called," concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. What was the last part of that mean? Possibly. Anybody else have a different take on that? I'm not sure. I know. I'm asking. I know sometimes y'all think I'm trying to lead you into a wrong answer where I could. No, that's not the case. I don't know. Does it mean that he was as good as dead? Because Abraham had the knife and he's about ready to stab him. I mean, he was as good as dead as far as Abraham was concerned. Maybe that's the idea behind it. But maybe what Adel says has some weight as well. But anyway, the main point is, he trusts in God completely. I know God is not going to lie to me. I know he's going to raise him up. And there's got to be some way that this promise will still be fulfilled tomorrow.
He doesn't say that Abraham, when he was tested, almost. And that would probably be the way we would say it. Okay. That he almost offered
it. Right. Yeah. And I think you had a question about this. When God stopped him, I think it's the angel of the Lord that speaks to him, right? There in verse 11. He tells him not to lay your hand on the lad and so forth. What does God say through this angel that he knows about Abraham? Verse 12, good passage for us to remember. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So, folks, you know, we've got some challenges to our faith. All along, there are some difficult things that we are asked to do. May we have the faith of Abraham. And while we're on this, Ann asked a good question back a few weeks ago concerning the. You know, we talked about Abraham's faith and how he showed it in several different ways, and we don't want to in any way minimize that. But we've also called Abraham in a couple of lives, right? And Ann just raised the question. She said, well, you know, sin being transgression of the law. Had there been any law given forbidding lying? I guess my question is, and it very much relates to what we just got to be saying about Abraham's trust and belief in God. How would Abraham know that he was wrong to lie? Why does he trust in God? Obviously, it has to do with the character of God, but what does he know for sure about God? We just got to be talking about
God's faith.
God is faithful. There is no way in this world that God's ever going to tell me a lie. Abraham knows that. And so, he knows the character of God is such that he would not lie. This is the God he serves. And so, I think if even if nothing specifically had been said concerning this, what he knows about God would tell him that he does not need to be dishonest or deceitful in any way. You know, there are other definitions of sin. 1 John 5 speaks of all unrighteousness is sin. This was unrighteousness. It was against the righteous character of God that Abraham knew very well. He didn't know everything, but he knew that. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about the faith of Abraham. By faith he, this is from Hebrews 11:9, he of course referred to Abraham, dwelt, the American Standard Version says, became a sojourner in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Question is, how does Genesis 23 illustrate Abraham's alien status? We know that Sarah dies. Sarah at the beginning of the chapter. Arrangements are made with the Hittites to buy this burial place, the cave of Machpelah. What, how does all this illustrate his alien status, his foreign status? I think the whole thing just very powerfully illustrates he's got no stake in this place. Okay. I mean, he has to purchase a piece of land to bury his wife. And so there's no real home here for Abraham in any, you know, I guess settled state. Now, we read from Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 9. It talks about by faith Abraham did this. And what does it go on in the very next verse to say? To explain why he could be content dwelling in this foreign land as a sojourner or as a pilgrim. What made him content to do that? What was he looking for? Yeah, he's looking for another home. Let's turn to Hebrews 11 verse 10. So I'll mess up the quotation there. Come on, read verses 9 and 10 together.
By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, their heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God.
Again, you know, every time I read that, I think, how much do you really know about heaven? You knew something. I mean, think about, you know, obviously we don't know how much was revealed to him about this city, which, you know, has no foundations, his builder and maker is God. Think about how much has been revealed to us. And I know we maybe still have questions about, you know, exactly what heaven will be like. And, you know, I think sometimes we get a little bit too curious because, my goodness, we're told enough to know it's, most wonderful place you can possibly imagine. But and we've been told a lot. Is our faith ever wavered? Are we looking for that city? And the thing about it is, that's the thing that sustains us through whatever difficulty we face, through whatever challenging command that we're given, through whatever challenging situation we may have to face. There is no more powerful sustaining force in our lives than the hope of eternal life. And we've got to be looking for that city. We can make it through whatever. God's oath to Abraham. We talked a fair amount about this this past Sunday morning there in Hebrews chapter 6. This is Hebrews 6, 13 and 14, and the quote right there in the middle is from our passage tonight, Genesis 22, 16 and 17. It says, for when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply you. And we talk about these two things that are immutable and how God cannot lie, but just further assurance that God was giving Abraham by swearing by himself. Well, to me, I think one thing maybe that can, further illustrate that passage from Hebrews, since it's to kind of compare God's oath to Abraham, him swearing by himself, to the servant's oath to Abraham. Remember now, the servant has been sent to go and find a wife for his son Isaac. And he makes the servant swear, you know, that he's going to do exactly like Abraham has commanded. Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 16 says, "For men indeed swear by the greater." Now God couldn't swear by anyone greater. So the men indeed swear by the greater. Now look at what Abraham asked him to do. Genesis 24 and verse 3. "And I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." So you've got an example here of somebody swearing by the greater. To me, that's just interesting to put God's oath right alongside this servant's oath to Abraham. Right, any other comments on any of that before we go further? Anything we've covered so far? All right. Let's talk about this test that the servant comes up with for this prospective wife for Isaac. And, of course, he talks to God about that. We'll talk some more about that in just a minute. But what is the test? For the camels. "I will say to her, you know, let down your pitcher to give me a drink. And if she does that, and she also says, let me get your camels some drink too. That's going to be a sign, you know, that she is the one." And again, we see that in Genesis 24, verse 14. Just to kind of, talk about, in some ways, how good of a test this would be. T.E. Lawrence, who's better known as Lawrence of Arabia, you may remember that from your studies of history, writes in The Seven Pillars of Wisdom on page 55 that when he lived among the Arabs, one time after a mere day's journey, they watered their camels and drank 5 gallons each. He observed them drinking 5 gallons of each. So, it's quite possible with the 10 camels this servant had, Rebecca drew 50 gallons of water. Well, it could have been less than that. I get it. But I imagine those camels were pretty thirsty. That's some work. It would indicate something, I think, about Rebecca. So I don't pretend to know all of the reasoning behind this. You know, we're not told, but just kind of knowing that, I think, helps us to kind of see how valuable that test would be. I want us to talk a little bit more about this servant there in Genesis chapter 24. I mean, obviously, we're impressed with God, first and foremost, in our reading. That's the way it should always be. We're very impressed with Abraham and his faith. We just got through talking about that to some degree. But I'll tell you what, this servant, there's a lot to be commended about this man. And I want us to kind of to go through and observe a few things from this chapter. And I don't know the best way to put this. I'll just go ahead and put it out there. I think you know what I'm talking about. But there seemed to be a constant consciousness of God on his part. In other words, an awareness of God. It's just like every step of the way, he was remembering God. To me, that's a lesson for us. I mean, we go through a lot of different things. We may go through several days when we're not here at services and really don't reflect on how this relates to God in any way, things that are going on, decisions that we're making, and so forth. How?
Well, I think verse 2 says something to it. The way I take it now is that Abraham said to his servant, oldest of his household. So I'm thinking that this man had learned a lot from
Oh, yeah, I think that would have happened. It had to have had a great impact on him, for sure. Okay. Verses 12 through 14. He prays to God for success. Beginning in verse 12, and he said, he's come, you know, this is when he's come to this well of water at evening time. O Lord God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day. And show kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, here I stand by the well of water. The daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now let it be that the young woman to whom I say, please let down your pitcher that I may drink. And she says, drink, and I will also give your camels a drink. Let her be the one you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. So you see him beseeching the Lord for success in this. Then in verses 26 and 27, he worships God, praises God, when he learns that this Rebecca, who of course said the magic word, so to speak, when he learns that she is of Abraham's family. Look at verses 26 and 27. Then the man bowed down his head and worshiped the Lord. He said, blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, being on the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. So, obviously, you know, Rachel takes him back to the house, and, you know, he has shown great hospitality to the men that are with him. Even the animals are given a place to stay. They're all taken care of. And so the hospitality is just really great here. And then they, of course, set some food down before the servant. And what does the servant say? Yeah. I'm not going to eat anything until... I mean, this was so important. So I'm not only trying to highlight the awareness of God that he had through all of this, his dependence upon God, but just how faithful he was in this service, just how reliable he was, how conscientious he was in fulfilling this task. Would not eat until he told his errand. Verse 33, food was set before him to eat, but he said, I will not eat until I have told about my errand. And he said, speak on it. And so, he goes on to give just a little snippet of what this mission is all about, right? Is that what he meant? He goes into tremendous detail. It's almost like the chapter repeats itself. You know, everything that Abraham had told him and everything that we've already read that he did and so forth, he tells them everything. Why do you think he tells them all of that in great detail? Yeah, because when he tells them, what is their reaction? I mean, basically the servant is asking for Rebecca's hand on behalf of Isaac. Yeah, verse 50, then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing comes from the Lord. We cannot speak to you either bad or good. And so I think that in part would explain the need for all the detail. To make sure that they know that this is of the Lord. I'm not just on a mission to find some attractive lady, you know, for, you know, my master's son. I mean, this is big. I mean, because remember, what was his concern when Abraham first sent him off? Yeah, well, what am I going to do if she doesn't come back? You know, do I need to go to the land that you came from? And we'll talk some more about that in just a minute. Abraham was pretty insistent about that one. No, don't you dare. Don't you dare go to the land that I come from, which would have been Ur of the Chaldees, right? Go back there. We'll talk some more about that in just a minute. So there's concern on his part, but boy, after he tells this and the detail that he does and explains God's role and all of that, that's the conclusion that they come to. He worships God again. Verse 52, when the family consents. It came to pass, this is of course, let's read 51 and 52. Here is Rebekah before you, take her and go, and let her be your master's son's wife, as the Lord has spoken. It came to pass, when Abraham's servant heard their words, that he worshipped the Lord, bowing himself to her. So I think this is very impressive. And then, he would not delay when Rebekah's brother and mother asked if she could stay home. Again, I think this just is his faithfulness to the mission, and he even mentions God's role in this again. Verse 54, let's start there. He and the men who were with him ate and drank and stayed all night. Then they arose in the morning and said, send me away to my master. But her brother and her mother said, let the young woman stay with us a few days, at least 10. After that, she may die. And he said to them, do not hinder me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away so that I may go to my master. So, again, you know, Bob brought out another point just a few minutes ago, but just all through this, you can't help but be impressed by this sermon. Any other comments on that? All right, let's look at one other thing here. We just mentioned this. One thing that Abraham was adamant about to his servant is, don't you take my son back there. Go back to my original family home. Why? But there may be someone that's family. See what you're saying. And I think that goes in with what. Let's look at something that, this Genesis 24 is where he is adamant about that. Joshua 24 and verse 2. Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, the father of David, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. Might help explain some of it. And he goes on later in that chapter, you got to choose who you're going to serve. Are you going to serve the gods that your father served on the other side of the river? Or are you going to serve the one true God? And so that might kind of help explain some of the reasons behind that. All right. I wanted to mention about the cave of Machpelah. Who is buried in that cave in our reading tonight?
Sarah
and Abraham. We're going to kind of, I guess, need to sort of keep in mind the cave of Machpelah because there's going to be some other folks buried here too, right? Let's see, Rebekah and Isaac, Leah and Jacob are all going to be buried. And I think that's the full list. I'm not sure. Who buried Abraham? I thought that was significant. Why would that be significant? Mama didn't get along, and when Isaac was weaned, what was Ishmael doing? Mocking him. Right. So it's kind of nice to see them together on this. I don't know what the atmosphere was. I'm not trying to speculate on that, but I do know there was that issue before. But they do come together to bury Abraham. But again, I'm not trying to make more significance out of that and all too, but the Bible record has it there. I think there's some significance to it. All right, we've got a couple minutes left, and I don't really have anything else. somebody has, yeah, go ahead now.